Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on Twitter/X. And yeah, nothing happened this weekend. How was your weekend? Because mine was really slow.
Really quiet. It's always nice to have a quiet weekend.
You could have heard a pin drop or a bomb. I'm not sure, one of the two, but I mean,
shock and awe.
You know, it's been a long time since I was basically working all weekend on this job because, you know, thankfully we have more bloggers than we used to. So I generally take Sundays off. You know, I write the Sunday reflection on Saturday. I take Sunday off. I try to, you know, do the whole Sabbath thing ever since Dennis personally lectured me very nicely. Dennis Prager very personally lectured me on keeping the Sabbath, right? Which was great advice. Not this weekend, man. I think I actually wrote more posts on Saturday than I do on a normal day. And I was pretty close yesterday too. We're recording this on Monday. Shock and awe. I mean, this is the story, right? This is the only story. We could talk about the State of the Union address, I guess, a little bit later on here, but I knew this was coming when Donald Trump only spent 1 minute on Iran in the State of the Union address. This was, and he wasn't even asking Congress for, you know, their advice and consent. He was just saying, yeah, this is a situation and it's going to be resolved soon sort of thing. And it was at that point, it's like, you know, if he's only spending 1 minute on Iran, he's made decisions. And, and sure enough, on Friday, now,
very astute of you.
Did you hear what happened though on the day of with Abbas Arachi and Stephen Witkoff?
No.
Okay. NBC News had this. And apparently they were in Geneva, which is where the talks were at that time. And the U.S. was insisting that Iran stop enriching uranium and that they needed to talk about the nuclear or about the ballistic missiles and terror proxies. And Arachi started yelling at Witkoff, apparently, because, and they weren't even direct negotiations at this point in time, but that Iran has a right to enrich and that the U.S. has no right to tell them not to enrich because Iran has a right to enrich. And Stephen Witkoff said, well, yeah, the U.S. has a right to stop you. And he's but she started yelling at him again. He says, you know, if you want, I can just leave. And that's what happened. Witkoff walked away. And it was just a few hours later that Arachi got Trump's response, Trump's and Israel's response. Those are fascinating little nuggets of history, I think.
I love that stuff. And I also heard that, I think it was an Israeli newspaper that Israel confirmed Khamenei's death before Iran did, and they had a picture.
they got a picture. I guess it was probably a surveillance drone that was over the ruins of the palace. Would be my guess. Yeah, they got a picture of it.
Well, they had, you know, they had people positioning the leaders. I just admire. Of course, it comes from millennia of persecutions, but the skills of the Jews are just phenomenal. I just, you know, the pagers blowing up and all this, and then I read that they hacked the leadership's personal messaging system to get them all in the same place.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me. They knew when they were. Okay. This is the thing that's bugged me all weekend long. Bugged me so much is just how in the world, when you have the biggest armada that the region has seen in 25 years or 23 years parked on your doorstep, and you have your foreign minister screaming at the Americans that you're never going to back down, how in the world do you decide that that's a really good time to have an in-place meeting with 50 of the most important people in Iran all in one spot?
Yeah. I have no inside information, but to me, that's the arrogance. They've been so used to playing the U.S. all these years, playing Obama, getting money, not doing what they agreed to, and deciding that they ought to learn. Syria learned that Trump doesn't bluff. Obama did. But Trump does not. Whether he took taking out Soleimani or bombing the airbase that launched the chemical attacks in Syria, or
grabbing Maduro. I mean, it was just six weeks ago, seven weeks ago. They grabbed Maduro.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't bluff, and as controversial as some of his actions are, I mean, I don't think he should talk quite so much about it, but as controversial as some of his actions are, the echoes or the reverberations around may cause some other bad guys to think twice.
Well, I think at this point in time, you have to say that the whole taco thing, you know, Trump always chickens out, is pretty much dead, right? I mean, I think that as you know, the Democrats like to trot that one out in terms of challenging him on, I think it was tariffs and a couple other things. And Trump always chickens out because he had backed off of tariffs at a couple different points because he was doing negotiations. Well, that's really not the case. Trump actually pretty much delivers, especially on threats. And so it's interesting. A couple of things that we should talk about. One is I'm curious as to how you're seeing the media coverage of this, because you know, I kind of see these, you know, sort of progressive narratives filtering into coverage here, and in certain instances I'm actually kind of surprised at how straightforward it has been. What's your take on that?
Well, I am not surprised. I think they're chasing a little bit Trump's lawsuits and threats and agreements and some changes in media have I think chastened some of the managements to behave better, and so they're a little bit more cautious. But you know, it's still going to come through. And the reality is that, you know, news is things that are happening. News is conflict. And if anyone stands up and says, you know, what he's doing is wrong, that's conflict. And so it's going to get covered. And they have learned that they don't have to do anything. They just have to criticize Trump. The word Trump in the headlines is golden for the news media. And they don't really think that much about the damaging, the impact of it. I'm not sure. This war is the most talked about war before it even happened. I'm a little bit bothered by it. I know it's part of his threat and his negotiation is, although he hasn't applied this to Putin, but Trump saying, I'm going to be deciding in a few days and stuff. Just, you know, decide. It's like, can't imagine Roosevelt saying, you know, we're thinking about a massive invasion of the French coast to finally end this Nazi threat. And when we do, it'll probably be when the moon is covered. So it's just, why do this? Just say we're thinking about it and we haven't decided. What you said about that State of the Union, that was very smart. I missed that. But I should have picked up on that.
I mean, I think he was pretty much convinced of what he was going to do. And I think it's showing, you know, he had again, we're talking about this on Monday afternoon. A few hours ago, there was the Medal of Honor ceremony where he took questions from the press, you know, which is something that Trump does regularly. Yeah.
I know. But talking about a time limit, okay? So 1 hour past 4 or 5 weeks, and he's going to be in trouble. That's just not something you need to do.
Well, he said, you know, it might be longer. We're going to do it until, you know, we're ahead of schedule, but we're going to continue as long as it right. takes so to achieve our objectives.
Leave it open. Don't talk any time frame, because this is going to get messier. And
yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, right now it's all going our way. It's going to be more difficult as it goes along. Although one of the things that Trump told Jake Tapper today was, oh, we haven't even started doing the big stuff yet. I mean, I'm not sure that might just be hyperbole. It might just be a way of rattling around, because, you know, there's a lot of psychological warfare going on here too. But I'm kind of wondering what he might have in mind, because the first few hours of Operation Epic Fury, they killed Khamenei and 48 of his closest leaders. Friend. And Trump.
Yeah.
Yep. So go ahead.
No, I agree with you. I understand his concern to head off the opposition, to try to snuff it before it gets any momentum about the war. And he's perfectly right. Didn't need to notify Congress. Obama didn't. In fact, when Obama joined the ousting of Gaddafi in 2011, he said it at a departure. He's taking his mother-in-law on a tour of South America, and he dropped in there that, oh, by the way, I've ordered that we join the attack on and Gaddafi. Now that took 9 months. It was supposed to be a lot quicker than that, but it took 9 months, and that was just a bombing campaign, and we lost.
Well, this is just a bombing campaign. And this brings up something that I really want to get back to here, which is that this is almost exactly like what Obama did with Libya 15 years ago, or 14 and a half years ago, I think, because I think it was more like the summertime, or maybe late summer, early fall. But it's the exact same thing. Obama declared a responsibility to protect Libyan citizens from being massacred by Gaddafi's forces. So he initiated a bombing campaign, and then a few weeks in, handed it off to NATO. They continued it with American participation, and he never reported that to Congress, not even the first 48 hours. And the War Powers Act allows a president to initiate this type of action, but he's got to report it to Congress within 48 hours, which I think Trump has done. Obama never did. And then you've only got 60 days, and Congress can maybe give you an extra 30, but at that point, you have to get congressional approval or withdraw the forces. Well, Obama never did. And he kept saying, well, you know, it's because we're not going to stand by and watch people be massacred. And besides which, we're not using ground forces, so it doesn't apply. And Nancy Pelosi, I got a video of this. I have a post written for later today. Nancy Pelosi affirmed this. They said, well, Obama says he doesn't need congressional approval. Is that right? And she says, yes. And now Democrats are insisting that this is illegal. You've got Tim Kaine pushing a War Powers Resolution Act to tell Trump to cease all activity. It's not going to go anywhere. It also has a huge loophole in it that Jonathan Turley discovered too, which is basically that it has an exception for imminent attacks from Iran. Well, Iran's sending missiles constantly. Yeah. The imminence is there already, so it's basically a moot point. It's virtue signaling. But what I'm amazed at, and not really amazed, is that the same people who were cheering Barack Obama for doing that with Libya are claiming that it's illegal now that Donald Trump has done the exact same thing. And after the massacre had taken place, the first massacre had already taken place.
And we've talked about this, but remember Ben Rhodes saying that the media is young and naive, and you can play them like a harp, and they'll do that. And besides, they're very sympathetic to the Trump is crazy and authoritarian and so on. I understand Hegseth today saying, not saying anything, but not ruling out ground forces. You don't want to rule anything out, but God help us. No, no. we don't want the ground forces.
I don't even know what you do with ground forces. Iran is huge.
I don't either, but there's never been a war won by only bombing. Okay. So you got to get them to collapse themselves. We bombed the hell out of Hanoi and North Vietnam, and that did nothing, and we still lost. So I hope we don't do anything with the ground force. Maybe some command.
Well, I mean, it worked in Libya. It actually worked in Libya.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Now, it worked short term. It worked in Libya, and then it became a huge problem later, but right, it did collapse the regime.
It did. It did. And it showed the fragility of the regime, and it was the country, I think, was ripe for it. And then, of course, 9 months later, the mob caught Gaddafi hiding in a culvert and tore him apart. So that removed him. There was no line of succession, and there were no more mullahs lining up to doing job interviews. So where do you see yourself in 5 years? Dead. I just the mention of ground forces is disturbing. That's another quagmire.
Yeah, I think it's mostly bluff, just a that part is just that we're keeping all of our options open. We haven't taken anything off the table yet. Not even a bluff, just saying all of our options are still on the table. We are not going to take anything off the table, which makes sense. Rhetorically speaking, and in terms of psyops, you know, you want them having to game out this stuff. What I do find interesting, though, is that, again, he's talking about several weeks of this. So there is a lot of targets that they want to hit, both us and the Israelis.
And that's good. You know, you don't want to go in with half measures and then have to go back in, and then everybody says, oh, here we go again. Do it big, get it over. And he's very smart. You remember when we ousted Hussein, we didn't have a plan for what happens when we win. When he ousted Maduro, we're sort of leaving the structure in place. And that's very smart. And Iranians are going to have to step up. I don't know if it's the prince or somebody, but they're going to have to step up. And there's aggrieved aggrieved minorities in Iran that they may have their thoughts about their own independence, and you know, they have a civil war over, no, we want this region for ourselves, and so on. It's a great nation with a cultural history that goes way back. It's messy and it's dangerous.
Well, they're trying to make it less dangerous. They've apparently sunk every ship in the Iranian Navy now. That's right, the claim, right. Including that brand new drone carrier, which was the first to go, apparently, as we were discovering today.
But no, the reverse side of that is we have big ships in the area, too.
So. Well, we do, but they have limited ways of getting to them. That's the thing.
They do, but others might not. I mean, I'm thinking of Taiwan and China and so on. So
it's worth discussing, I think, because I've seen people say, well, China is now going to make a move on Taiwan while we're tied up here. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think China is looking at this, and they're looking at it the same way that Russia's looking at this. Because as it turned out, a few days ago, apparently, the Iranians went to Russia and asked them to do military drills so that their military was in harm's way. And Russia said, it's been good to know you. Yeah. And the Iranians now are lamenting having allied with fair weather allies like Vladimir Putin. I honestly think that after looking at what happened in Venezuela and what's happening right now in terms of Iran, we're demonstrating capabilities, I think, that they either were unaware of or were convinced we'd never want to use. And I think that as long as Trump's president, I think Chinese are going to hold off on the whole Taiwan thing. They'll talk big about it, but I suspect that they're not interested in getting into this. And not just because the U.S. would intervene, but because Taiwan has the same technology we do. I mean, we share these systems and we share, you know, strategies and all of this. And China's army has largely been untested since Vietnam. I'm not even sure they were that involved in Vietnam. That was mostly the Soviets. Certainly they're involved in Korea, but China, they haven't been in combat in decades. And one of the things that you see with the types of military leadership that these regimes produce is that they reward toadies and party hacks over people who actually know what they're doing. And you never get a chance to develop the type of initiative and innovation and it's not adaptation.
And it's not part of the culture.
It's not part of the culture either, right?
The individualism of Americans, actually Western.
Western militaries operate on initiative. You know, one of the things that happened almost immediately in Abbas Arachi was saying was, so we are now going into mosaic mode or whatever it is that they call it, mosaic something or other, which means that basically all these units can operate independently. My guess is this is the first time that they've ever been allowed to operate independently and will have no idea what to do and can no longer coordinate. That can be very dangerous for, you know, a very short period of time. But the problem is that these units tend to fall apart if they're asked to do something that would have gotten them killed the day before.
No, I agree. A couple of things. One, I think that's why we're being so cautious about getting rid of Putin, because there's a lot of factions in Russia, and each one of them has nuclear weapons. So it's not something we need to address right now. But pulling back for a moment and looking, there appears to be, certainly not noticed in the media, but a much larger strategic picture Trump is employing. Okay, and let's look at the pieces here. Russia is being degraded. Its military is being degraded, and it will take a very long time to rebuild it. They're losing thousands every month. I've seen 30,000. I've seen less than that every month. And their military has been degraded. In fact, Biden's head of the military, the chairman, he said at the very beginning that this would be helpful to degrade Russians' capability. But beyond that, look at this. So Russia is busy, it's occupied, and it's losing men and equipment. Venezuela was a major supplier of oil to China. That's out of the picture now. Iran was a major supplier of oil to China.
That's and Russia. Why. Well, Russia produces their own oil, but
they were building a pipeline to China. But the two largest suppliers of oil to China are now out of the picture. So that's that's going to give should give you pause if you're a rational decision maker strategically. And, you know, Trump's not getting any credit for that. And I don't know whether that would be useful or not. But looking at the big picture, this is there is a bigger picture at play here. And like you suggested, give China pause for starting something, even though we might physically be unable to have a two front war going on. We could switch.
We could switch and we can make things very difficult. But I think Taiwan itself would be very difficult. And I think maybe China's starting to think about how Russia's military has performed in the field and how the Iranian military has performed in the field. And if they're smart, if they're rational, they may be wondering how their own military would perform under pressure. It's one thing for internal oppression, you know, internal dissent suppression. It's a whole other thing when you're engaged against an enemy that knows what they're doing.
Yeah. And Iran is the major supplier of drones for Russia, which is their main effort, or their certainly a major effort in Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And I mean, that drone production got damaged and then redirected back to Iran after the 12-day war. But that's probably one of the reasons why Russia was like, well, we're not getting drones anymore, so see you later. I still think drones are overrated when you've got a military that has other options. So I got reamed in the comments for this, but I'm going to explain this. Is that people were saying, well, you know, Iran has the, you know, best drone performance, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, it's great for taking out old ladies in Tel Aviv, but it doesn't really stand up to a robust military operation. And the U.S. uses drones, and we use them very effectively. But we pick and choose our spots. They are not our primary, our primary platform. The platforms that we use are, you know, the USS Gerald Ford, the USS Abraham Lincoln, B-2 bombers, because we have those types of assets. The problem for Iran is they don't have anything else. This is what they've got. They have tried to put fighters in the air a couple of times, at least a few times over the last couple of days, and they're just getting taken out of the air as soon as they get up there, because our stuff is just a hell of a lot better than their stuff, and we train our pilots better.
Which brings me to a major mystery. Bahrain shot down 3 F-35s.
Are you talking about Kuwait? Kuwait.
Yeah, I thought Kuwait. Which is friendly fire. But wait a minute. Those F-35, well, first of all, that's...
Were they F-35s or were they F-15s? I thought I heard that they were F-15s. Well,
I read 35s, but I hope that they were 15s. But either way, how do you do that?
It was anti-aircraft fire. And these weren't stealth. This is the reason, you know, people were saying, well, how come all these other nations aren't sending fighter jets or bomber jets into Iran? The problem is that the airspace is crowded, and you have to coordinate that. You can't just say, oh, well, we're going to fly in there too, because you're going to get shot down. They use something called Identify Friend or Foe, IFF systems. And this is one of the things that has been an issue in sales to Israel and sales to Turkey. Is the IFF and radar systems too. And, you know, because some of this stuff is very high security stuff. We've gotten over it with Israel. We never did with Turkey.
Thankfully.
Exactly. But I suspect what happened is that there was some sort of IFF screw up and they didn't recognize them as friendlies. And so they thought that they were incoming missiles and sent up the ABM stuff and ended up, you know, basically anti-aircraft is what it turned out to be.
But the the planes, whatever they are, whatever models they are, they're not defenseless. They know what's coming or what's they.
I think they got surprised. I think they got surprised.
That's something they're we need flying, to work
flying
on.
Back over friendly territory, and all of a sudden you have bursts all around your aircraft. I'm glad that the pilots got out. You saw the video of the female pilot, right? Who was approached in Kuwait, and they're coming up and saying, "We're really sorry. Thank you so much for helping us out." And the pilot's got this smile on her face. Like, "Well, no problem."
Yeah.
Thanks for giving me a couple of weeks off, I guess. But I'm glad that they all, you know, that they all made it back safely. But six, right now we're up to six casualties. And there's going to be more. And some of this is going to put some pressure on Donald Trump, too. As casualties, American casualties start coming in, there's going to be some pressure on Trump that about are we getting what we're sacrificing? Are we getting, you know, is this worth it? I think he made a good argument about that today. I think Hegseth addressed it head on, saying there's going to be more casualties, but this mission is worth it because it's really about our interests in that region and the fact that Iran wants to kill Americans, and we have to put an end to it.
Absolutely. I mean, interests in the region, I don't get excited about that, but developing a nuclear weapon in a rogue state or owned by a rogue state is something that needs to be prevented. That's for sure.
If we'd done this with North Korea at the time, we wouldn't be in the situation that we are on the peninsula at the moment, too. I mean, we missed this opportunity with North Korea. The difference is that as nutty as Kim Jong-il, right? Kim Jong-un is, his father was Kim Jong-il. As nutty as he is, he's rational. He wants to survive. He's not looking to create a Armageddon in which the 12th Imam will walk out of the Korean mountains and bless his regime. He wants
all power. That's it. There were three U.S. presidents who never got Kim to talk. Okay. Trump did, and how he got him to talk was he sent the same thing that happened in the Mideast. He sent two carrier strike forces, task forces, to the region. And like you say, Kim, he's strange, but he's rational. So we'll talk. And he stopped his missile tests and so on. We haven't gotten anything substantive out of it, but it was progress compared to what was there before. And he was forced to face a reality. And Trump was not afraid. Other presidents were, but Trump was not afraid to show his steel fist. And American presidents recently have been reluctant to do that. And especially in Asia, okay, I lived there for a while. The thing that surprised, one of the biggest lessons I took away is that the idea of mercy does not exist in Asian societies. It explains the rape of Nanking and Japanese extremities during the war. Also, if you act like a good guy, something that in our society, Western society, would be seen as a good gesture, that is a sign of weakness, okay? It's not a positive. It's not a positive. It's not something that causes them to go, oh, well, we should reciprocate with a goodwill gesture. No, that does not exist. And so acting tough and being willing to show you're willing to act tough is very important. If you're powerful and you don't show it and you don't show that you're willing to use it, you're not powerful.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Yep.
Well, that's, we didn't even get to your columns. There's great columns over at Red State for Andrew. Need reasons to vote this year. Dems plot serious retributions on Trump supporters, and the cancer of woke is alive and malignant in Maryland. Go check out both of those. Andrew, yeah, do you have any jokes? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I do. But the Sunday column on it's emerging on the Democrat side of retribution once they get back in power. So if there's anyone who's thinking, maybe I'll vote, maybe I won't, get over that real quickly, because we're not talking showcase. We're not talking just showcase impeachment trials in the House, in a Democrat House. We're talking, well, Senator Murphy was talking about prison. Susan Rice is talking about trials and going after corporations, not just individuals, people who have supported Trump or been seen to be supportive by the leftist extremists there. So to me, this is a very serious warning. And yes, I do have a couple of jokes.
Can I?
Well, talking about regime change, Ed Morrissey has shown that he can't take the pressure of wartime of coverage. And so I'm making a move now. We decapitated the hot air podcast, and Malcolm is moving in. Malcolm on the right. It's going to change names. Oh, hi, Ed. You're back.
I'd be happy. I'd be actually happy if you did that. Wow, 17 years of partnership, and the very first moment that he sees an opening, it's like,
there. And also, I must say, I have cut Ed's oil supply.
Well, he has done that. Yeah, you know, I haven't been able to use my hair oil for quite a while. So, yeah. Okay, jokes of the week, Malcolm.
Okay, I've got one. I forget who did it, but it's an old one. Is that Al Gore starts talking about the danger of global warming and the importance that the world is going to, ocean levels are going to rise because of the melting of the ice caps. And then Tipper says, Al, just pay the kid for shoveling the drive.
All right, that's pretty good.
And I have one other one. That's two guys play golf every week. And two old guys. And on the ninth hole, suddenly one of them stops, goes over to the edge of the tee and takes off his hat and stands there as a procession of cars go by. And his buddy says, oh, what's going on? And he said, well, I think it's the least I can do after 38 years of marriage.
Okay. We're going to get in trouble with our wives. We're going to get in trouble with our wives from today's jokes, because I've got one joke for you today. And from jokesoftheday.net, I love jokesoftheday.net, says two middle-aged women come before King Solomon, and they're dragging this finely dressed young man between them. And the king's advisor says, what is it that you want from the king? And the first woman says, this young lawyer agreed to marry my daughter. And the second woman says, no, 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 he agreed to marry my daughter. And they start arguing back and forth, back and forth. And finally, King Solomon raises his hand. He says, turns to the advisor and says, bring me my biggest sword, and I'm going to cut this young attorney in half. And each of you can have half, and that will be justice. And the first lady says, well, that sounds good to me. And the second woman says, no, 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 do not spill innocent blood. Let the other woman's daughter marry him. And the king waits for a moment and says, all right, this young man has to marry the first woman's daughter. And the advisor turns around and looks at him and says, but she was willing to cut him in half. And he says, indeed, that shows she's the true mother-in-law. I like that one. Our wives we're going to be in so much trouble with our wives, but I like that one too. So
yeah, right.
All right.
So, It's the least we can do after all these years.
Andrew Malcolm is the prince of Twitter, but he won't cut your young lawyer in half to prove it, which is great. He's also the regent of redstate.com and still will not cut your prospective son-in-law in half.
Nor will I play golf.
There you go. At AH Malcolm on Twitter, that's where you can find him. Redstate.com, that's where he writes. Andrew, so much fun today. Let's do this again next week.
Okay, buddy. Take care. Thanks, everybody. See you then.